It's NOLA History Guy podcast for Saturday, April 27th, 2019. And welcome to the pod. Boy, what a gorgeous day. The gods, goddesses, and muses are smiling down on the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival today. We go from the unbelievably torrential downpour of Thursday to yesterday and today just being perfect festing weather. And perfect almost to a fault, because I hope you guys remember your sunscreen. There's going to be tourists out there that are just going to get roasted. I was at the coffee shop earlier, you know, at my favorite PJ's anniversary engine in pulling the crescent today. We'll put that up on the train site later. But anyway, I was there, and you could tell people heading to the fest, you know, with the awful fedoras and the awful straw hats and some of the white skin that I saw. And that's my problem too on a day like today. Back when I used to referee soccer, you know, you get suckered in, you know, the breeze is cool and the day is wonderful, and you forget that the sun is bearing down. You come home and you look like a crawfish that just got out of the pot. So be careful. Yeah, hopefully everybody, you know, take this for advice if you're listening to it later after you come home and you realize you've roasted. You know, take good care of your skin, because you know, you got tomorrow and a whole nother weekend to go if you're going out to the fest. So we've got two things on the pod today. We're going to taking the best of Catherine Campanella's Today in New Orleans History for the week, and that's going to be the capitulation, the surrender of New Orleans in 1862, which happened that year this week. And then we're going to we're going to unpack a photo, but the photo is actually related to Today in New Orleans History as well, because on April 23rd, 1939, out on the lakefront in Milneyburg, Pontchartrain Beach opened their biggest attraction, the Zephyr roller coaster. And so we're going to pull up an image of the beach, and we're going to unpack that a little bit as well. So that's our two items that we're doing for the pod today. So we'll go ahead and let's get rolling. One quick item before we get started, and that's a shout out to our local independent booksellers on Independent Booksellers Day, which is more than an appropriate thing to be on a Saturday in Jazz Fest, because the local booksellers association, it's kind of a co-op coalition, runs annually a book tent at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. And this year the book tent is under the management, I guess is the way to say it, this year of the Blue Cypress Books up on Oak Street. And that's my friend Elizabeth Alquist's bookstore, which is just a wonderful place. And I'll put the link to the shout out that I did on the ebrandley.com, you know, on my personal website. It's my personal and writing website, more for the fiction and verse and me just to, you know, kind of be personal as opposed to NOLA History Guy, you know, which here it's a bit more, little bit more history, obviously. But a big shout out to all of the independent booksellers, in particular Elizabeth, and then an equally big shout out to Tom Lowenberg up at Octavia Books, who has run the book tent at Jazz Fest before when I've been out there signing books, and has had me up as well. Both Elizabeth and Tom have been very gracious in inviting me to events to come sign books and that kind of thing. And Tom will have me up when the new history books have come out and do a little talk and everything else. And I've certainly enjoyed many a good talk by other authors up at Octavia as well. The last time I've been up there, it actually will tie to the pod today, and I'll put the note on the show page for that as well. Is the last time I was up at Octavia Books was to hear Brian Batt talk about his book, about his family, and Pontchartrain Beach, because the Batts are the ones that Harry Batts, the guy who brought the Zephyr here, he brought the beach here. One of these days we'll have to do, we'll do another cornerstone pod, if you will, on that. But today we'll just unpack the photo and go from there. But anyway, yes, it's Independent Booksellers Day. Go out, if you don't listen to this till tonight, definitely go out, to your bookstores that are out, that are open tomorrow or during the week, just because we recognize it's not like, you shouldn't be just going one day a year anyway to these wonderful places and these temples of learning, knowledge, fun, etc. Just support them all year long. Go up to Octavia, go buy some stuff. It's where I buy all my long-term notebooks for doing my day planning and my bullet journal. Go over to Blue Cypress, by all means. Go tell Elizabeth hi and go pet the cat. It's like any bookstore that has a shop cat must be rewarded and continue. So the shout out to all of the hardworking people at the indie bookstores. They understand what that a bookstore is more than just that prime truck showing up in front of your house. And let's talk about our first item where we're going to, our pick for the week from Today in New Orleans History, which is Catherine Campanella's website, neworleanspast.com. Or if you're following on, if you do more on Facebook, look for, just go into the search box and look for Today in New Orleans History. And that's the page where she puts her stuff up. So our pick for this week, we actually have two picks this week, but our photo unpack, but I'll explain that later. But our pick this week from Today in New Orleans History is her April 25th entry. And that is the capture of New Orleans, or the way she says it, New Orleans captured by federal troops. It's more appropriate to say New Orleans captured by the United States Navy on the 25th. The federal troops get there, but they get there. They are coming across from Ship Island with Butler. So they're not quite there yet, but the Navy gets the Navy gets the props and gets the glory initially for the victory. Now what happened basically is the Southern states secede, rebel against the United States. Louisiana and most of the rest of the what are styled as the Confederate States of America secede from the Union in early 1861. And so that's kind of the I refer to pretty much that time from, say, February of 1861 to May 1st or to late April of 1862 as the secession year, where it's a combination of Louisiana is an independent republic and then pretty much turns around. And as soon as the Confederate States of America forms approves a constitution and forms a government, then Louisiana becomes part of that. By the fall of 1861, the Union forces are fully engaged. Well, depends on. This is where you get into the Army of the Potomac and the inertia in the Virginia theater, but certainly as far as the U.S. Navy is concerned, things start moving. Blockade squadrons are formed and move down the coast, down the Atlantic coast, and start to be implemented and start to move into the ports, moving into Norfolk, down through the Carolinas, Savannah, then through Florida, and then over into the Gulf, and blockading squadrons entered the Gulf, blockading Pensacola, Mobile, the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and then, of course, New Orleans. And by the time everything's set up and in place, the blockade is an economic disaster for the city of New Orleans. Now, we were the second largest port in the nation and the largest port in the rebel states. And the Union Navy, you get the romanticization of blockade runners, but let's face it, commerce just wasn't going through. The European ships, French and British concerns were not coming to New Orleans. The Spanish as well, either out of trade and connections between Havana and New Orleans, were all but severed at that point. And New Orleans, well, was blockaded. And if you go back and look at the history of successful naval blockades, it's a bad thing. It's what the Union Navy did to New Orleans is basically what the British with the Royal Navy did to Napoleon in the French ports back in during the early 19th century. So it was not good. And the rebel government did not fully understand what was going on here, and that was part of the problem. Frankly, it was really the loss of New Orleans, ignoring the significance of New Orleans, really just demonstrated the abject incompetence of the rebel government. Now, lost cause mythos over time tries to work through that, but you just can't work through what happened at New Orleans with the lost cause mythology. You don't have the Wellington we never had, or the in Lee, and the Marshal Murat that we never had with Jeb Stuart, and the flamboyant cavalrymen. Yeah, it's like you don't have that. What we've got is you've got a blockade of all the ports along the English Channel and the Atlantic coast, and starving out the French is what you've got. So and it plays out the same way over the winter of 1861 to 1862. Now the Union knows that the best thing they can do is to separate the rebels via the Mississippi River. And it's basically the idea is, if you can come at the rebel forces from top and bottom, then it's just going to be that much easier to be victorious in the Western theater. So Western Army coming in, coming down from St. Louis and coming down from Ohio. And now we have the Navy blockading the Gulf Coast and developing an invasion force, essentially, for New Orleans. So this all starts with a blockading squadron run by commanded by Flag Officer David Farragut. And Farragut comes in, establishes the blockade, builds up his forces, but he also brings along a squadron of what are called mortar vessels. And basically it's a squadron of smaller ships that have the big mortar guns. If you don't know what a mortar is, we'll sort that out. But the idea is, put a shell in and fire it off at a high angle, and it's essentially a bomb with a fuse, and it goes off on an arc and goes a distance and then drops wherever you want it based on the angle of the mortar. So when you know you have two fixed fortifications on the river that you've got to beat, you bring in the mortars and you stand off a little bit down the river where you have control, and then you just bomb the heck out of those locations. And that bombing, combined with the realization that the continued governing of New Orleans or continued control of New Orleans by the rebels made a very serious impression on two groups of soldiers that were occupying Fort Jackson, which is was the primary fort down the river, and that was a battalion of Irishmen and a battalion of Germans, and they were two-thirds of the garrison of the fort at Fort Jackson. And those two battalions, along with a battalion of planter class, white folks who were more loyal to the rebel cause, were the three, that was the three units that garrisoned the fort. And on the night of the 24th, going into the 25th of April, 1862, the Germans and the Irish mutinied. They just said, we're done. Some of them walked out the fort. Others just put down their weapons and refused to man the cannon in the fort. And this was the opening that Farragut needed. He was able to pass on the Fort Jackson side of the river, which is the western side of the river, as he's coming up. Now remember, the whole east-west thing is a mess in itself, but we know that. But so he's able to come in though on that side of the river, and by dawn, by morning, there are 13 Union ships that are in the harbor at New Orleans, and Mansfield Lovell, who's the general, isn't happy about it, but you know, he gets in and just leaves, and he's already pulled out the bulk of the troops because he was ordered to. The army regulars had moved up into Tennessee or all the way to the Army of Northern Virginia for the serious fighting. That left really just not much left but militia units that had never trained, and even most of those, anybody who was willing to go, had already pulled out up to rebel forts up in Baton Rouge or past Baton Rouge. So by the time Farragut gets there, there's really just not much left in terms of defenses. So the city, though, still the pro-rebel forces or population of the city still was defiant. You have the incidents where Union flag was pulled down at the U.S. Mint, and other German records of German immigrants who were standing along the levee and waving at the Farragut ships as they were coming up the river, and people were shooting and killing the pro-union, the Unionist folks that were showing, say, hey, we're glad to see you, kind of liberation sort of thing, and then you got white guys shooting them down as they're expressing that. But so what happens, of course, is that the initial orders to surrender, or initial trip into the city to surrender, to accept the surrender, is rejected, and so Farragut sends back another detachment with armed Marines to compel the surrender of the city in the afternoon of April 25th, 1862. At that point, the city is now under Union control. By May 1st, Major General Benjamin Butler comes is in the city with 3,300 or so Union troops as an occupying force. And from there, the city and the port of New Orleans returns to operation. Essentially, the port, Butler takes steps to reopen the port. Farragut takes his ships and they move further upriver to support combat operations in Baton Rouge. And as things move forward to do that top and bottom approach to separate the rebel army in the west, that about sums up what happened. And of course, like I said, it's just the level of ignorance of the significance of the city of New Orleans was one of the major downfalls, because it's one of the reasons why the lost cause of the Confederacy has become such a mythology, because it's a way to to work out and excuse some of this awful, this terrible ineptitude on part of the government, and saying, you know, it's like, well, we have these magnificent stories, but they lost, and they didn't just lose. They ignored the economics behind things. They didn't have the port. They couldn't get in. There was no way if the Europeans wanted to help the rebel states, they just weren't able. The Royal Navy or the French Navy certainly wasn't going to come in, and they weren't going to mess with Farragut and the Union Navy, is this they weren't going to try to bust that blockade, and then they now would be the invading force coming into New Orleans. So just wasn't going to happen. And then you get in all the stories about Butler and everything else, and I don't really want to go there, because most of that, again, is just lost cause mythos that's not true. So but we'll leave it at that for now. You know, it was this week in 1862 that the blockade essentially is lifted. The Irish and the Germans, those two communities in the city who were suffering great hardship because of the closure of the port, you know, you don't have jobs, your family's going hungry, you enlist in an army that's not paying you because that army doesn't have a lot of money in the first place and doesn't have a lot of respect for you because you're an immigrant and Catholic in the second place. And all of a sudden, Farragut and Butler are on the scene, and the Union knows the value of the port and reopening commerce, so goods start flowing back in, and then that of course supplies the Union cause. So that's this week. That's our pick for the most interesting, as far as we're concerned, day in today in New Orleans history. I've got other things going on. We're gonna do a Patreon segment for the pod today, and I've got some other stories about that time frame in New Orleans that I'm working on as well. So we're gonna go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we're gonna unpack a photo about Pontchartrain Beach. NOLA History Guy is sponsored in part today by Elysian Fields Press, publishers of Dragon's Danger, Book 1 of the Bloodbound series by Edward Branley. Don't believe everything you read on the internet. Joey, Anne Marie, and David are three teens from New Orleans. They're smart enough to understand this. Imagine their surprise when a dragon's egg they bought online turns out to be from an ancient trading company that sells collectibles and curiosities. Suddenly, it's more than just kidding around as they help their dragon avoid danger and evolve to its full potential. The Bloodbound series, Dragon's Danger, and its sequel, Dragon's Discovery, are young adult novels written by Edward Branley. They're set in New Orleans, and the age range for these novels runs anywhere from about 12 years old to adult, because it's young adult fiction. The novels are basically about the story of three 16-year-old high school students. So they're basically a bit PG in terms of language, if that's a problem for parents who are discerning what, you know, their preteens should read. Then you might want to consider that. But certainly they're solid young adult fiction. They're available online at Amazon in paperback and for Kindle. They're also available in a number of local bookstores, most notably Blue Cypress Books up on Oak Street. And there are also signed copies of the series are available at ElysianFieldsPress.com. That's all one word, ElysianFieldsPress.com. And we're back. Talking now about things a little more pleasant and a little more fun than war and combat and naval ships and bombs and forts. We're going to talk about Pontchartrain Beach. It was one of these things that's kind of, as going through, trying to, you know, make a pick on today in New Orleans history, and which day to take as the day to talk about this week. realized that there were two things. There's the surrender, the capture of New Orleans, and but then also on April 23rd, 1939, something really near and dear to a lot of New Orleanians happened, and that was the opening of the feature attraction, or what becomes the feature attraction at the Pontchartrain Beach Amusement Park in Milneburg, and that's the Zephyr roller coaster. So So to kind of mark that as well, let's unpack an image of the main entrance of Pontchartrain Beach. Now, this is a painting that was done by my friend Jane Brewster, who is janebrewster.com, and I saw her this morning out at the Palmer Park Arts Market, as a matter of fact. Jane is really, really good at taking older photos, maybe they're black, and in particular black and white photos that or slides that that she comes across, and people say, I'd love to have this done better, kind of thing, and she'll take a commission and take a picture of a neighborhood or a picture of a building or a house, and does just do so much with it because she's got such great talent. That's kind of the idea with this particular image. It's a view of the basically the traffic circle at Elysian Fields Avenue at the lake in Milneburg, and that is where the Pontchartrain Beach Amusement Park was from 1939 until it closed in 1984. Now, the thing with the beach, of course, the beach goes back to 1928-29 when Harry Batt Harry Batt's family business was an ice business. They delivered ice to a lot of the restaurants and the hotels and other establishments up at West End and then out at Spanish Fort. And as time goes on, a lot of the amusements, in particular at Spanish Fort, change hands. The area changes as well. The levee board starts. The Orleans levee board starts reclaiming the land along the lakefront in the 1920s. Batt opens up an amusement park on the eastern side of Bayou St. John and calls it Pontchartrain Beach. And it was a success. It did quite well until the levee board started reclaiming more and more of the land, and the amusement park wasn't on the lakefront anymore because they were going a little further out. Because the land had gone further out, and so the amusement park idea was put on hold as he went to look for a new location. And of course, 1929 was a significant year in the nation's economy because that was the crash in the beginning of the stock market crash in the beginning of the Great Depression. So over the next couple of years, you got to be careful about what you're doing. He's letting the ice business keep rolling, and he's kind of scouting around for some place to restart the amusement park, and the ideal place at that point is out not at Bayou St. John now, but at Milneburg Pier out at the end of Elysian Fields. Now, Milneburg, and we'll put up links for this and everything, goes back a long time, but it was a very good. A good stable area. And introduce into this now the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, who are doing all sorts of things in the area. In particular, building out the concrete seawall that runs along the lake in Orleans Parish. The seawall runs up to where Pontchartrain Beach is now, pauses for a little bit, and then picks up after the beach property. And the idea there is that at this time, so this is late 1930s, there's a lot a lot of this beach area is military installations. You've got the Higgins boat stuff that's starting to ramp up. He's not in full production yet in the late 30s, but you got some of that. There's the big Army hospital down at West End and the lake. Then just move over along the lakefront, and you get the NAS New Orleans, which is the Naval Air Station, is being developed. And then go a little further past Elysian Fields over to Franklin Avenue, and the Army has a supply depot there that is Camp Leroy Johnson. And in the midst of all this, the government and WPA, they're looking for things to develop, and one of the ideas was let's develop an amusement park, because we've got all these people who are going to be out here. People are going to move out here as these industries and Consolidated Aircraft and the airplane factory on the other side of Franklin Avenue from Camp Leroy Johnson. So you got stuff going on here, and even though the war has begun in the sense that the instability has begun, and then in 39, of course, that's when Hitler invades Poland. But at the time, federal government's looking for construction projects. Harry Batt pitches the idea of let's set up an amusement park with a swimming area. We'll truck in sand and we'll make a beach along the Lake Pontchartrain shore. Now, there's no natural sand there. It's kind of, just a swamp marsh kind of thing, and that's building out the seawall and constructing Lakeshore Drive makes sense. So Batt comes in and says, yeah, let's make a beach. And then you guys, we're pitching building a big men's and women's bathhouses so you can, come out to the beach and change and swim and everything else. He starts bringing in the amusement rides and bringing back the concept, the full-blown concept of an amusement park like he had closer to Bayou St. John 10 years earlier. The whole thing builds out. It's a success. And Batt brings in what becomes the feature attraction of Pontchartrain Beach in April of 1939. He brings in a big wooden roller coaster, and that wooden roller coaster was named the Zephyr. Now, if you look at, fast forward a little bit, kind of 20-ish years later, is the image. It's not sure dating that image. It's late 50s, maybe early 60s. The big thing there is some older. It's the cars. There's like a station wagon that looks late 50s. There's a United cab, the old black and white cabs, and a school bus that look late 50s as well. And then you've got a Nopsy old looks bus, the old maroon and cream buses, which by the 70s, Elysian Fields was running on much more modern buses because connecting LSUNO, the university, back into town kind of rated the better buses. But those old look buses, were still running at the time on the Elysian Fields line. And then if you look in the back, you've got the Zephyr, and it's that big wooden roller coaster, and you've got that first hump, that first hill. When you were inside the park, you could see the main entrance there, and you'd come in, and at this time that would have just been a basic admission, at that time probably free admission, and then you bought tickets for the individual rides, so you made your way just right over to this beautiful Art Deco train station, if you were looking, kind of looking like a fancy Art Deco train, like a streamliner train. And that was the entrance to the Zephyr. You bought your ticket, and then you went up onto the platform, and there were two trains for the roller coaster, so you could keep people moving. You got into this low open train cars, roller coaster cars. Nothing anywhere near like the stuff you see now, because of the steel roller coasters with their loops and loops and turns and everything else, where you got to strap in with shoulder harnesses. You just kind of climbed in, and then up you go over that big wooden hill with the track, and you could hear the clickety clack of the winch, the motor pulling the coaster train up to the top of the first hill. And at the top of the first hill, there was a little light tower with a beacon. And so, people, Chris, it's like you're always raising your hands so you could be able to not hold on, right? Just raise your hands and keep your hands up the whole time through the ride. Go over that first hump, and that's what Jane captures in the image is the car has just started the free fall, going down that first big hill. And so you get that thrill of the rush of the big downhill, and then you hit the bottom of that, and it goes up the second hill, which is a smaller because we're on just relying on gravity at this point, so it's a little bit smaller, and then a little bit smaller, then the big turn that kind of makes a big U-turn essentially, and the Zephyr and the train turns on a bit of an angle, not incredibly steep, but enough to be fun. And then a series of little bumps in the background as you go vroom, vroom, over these bumps and through a little tunnel, and you're back in the station, and out you go, and do you want to ride again? That kind of thing. Now, Chris, by the time I got there, as a kid with the family, I never really remember how we paid, pay tickets and, get a little ticket book and pay for the ride at that point. But when I was in high school, that was when POP, pay one price, began. And so it was like, $3.99 or $2.99 or $3.99. By the time I was a sophomore, it was $4.95 a piece. And so you basically just pay up, and then at the high school times at that point in the mid 70s, we would just ride the Zephyr over and over and over again, and it was just so much fun. So that's the image, of course, is you can see the big image with all the big entrance with all the flags, and that was on a traffic circle, so the cars and buses would pull up, you could drop people off, and then if you're come in your family car, you can drop people off and then go back over and park the car. The buses, school buses, the NOPSI buses would pull up there and then do drop off and pick up. That was kind of the end of the line for the Elysian Fields bus. And then it would turn around and head back into town. And just the memories of that, that's anything from, when I was a kid in the 60s all the way through high school, up to the sad days of the end of the closure of the park. Now, I mentioned talking about Independent Booksellers Day, Independent Bookstore Day, that one of the talks that I really enjoyed recently at Octavia Books up on Octavia and Laurel Streets was a talk by Brian Batt, the actor, who's his family owned Pontchartrain Beach, and he actually lived out at Pontchartrain Beach on the property. And so he's written a book that's just a wonderful memoir and a wonderful tale. And you want, if you spent time at the beach as a teen or a kid or even a little bit older, you definitely want to read Batt's book. It's just fond memories of everything. He solicited a lot of stories from people before he wrote the book, and then of course included things about his his personal experiences as well. So it's just a lot of fun. So this is all April 23rd, 1939. The Zephyr started this week and was gave us decades of fun out at the beach. Excitement before now all of the incredibly technical roller coasters that we see at the bigger amusement parks. So it was a fun little image to look at and unpack. As I said, this is Jane Brewster's image photos that she has worked with and recreated into this beautiful painting. And you can buy prints of that at she's got her Art by Jane Brewster Facebook page. That if you just search on her name, you'll be able to find that. And then janebrewster.com, which we'll obviously put up in the show notes as well. So that's pretty much our unpacking for the week. And that's all we've got this week for the pod. Well, that's all we've got for this. We're going to do an additional segment, a Patreon segment, as well that you'll be able to pick up on the site. It won't be part of the iTunes and the the regular pod distribution, but we'll have that as well for our Patreon patrons. Other than that, you know, like I say, it's just gorgeous. I hope you're having a good day. The arts market was kicking this morning, and you just know things are rocking at Jazz Fest. I didn't go today. I'm go out next weekend. So I hope you're in wherever you are, that your day is as glorious as it is here in New Orleans. And you go have a good one, and get a great week next week. And we'll talk to you next Saturday here on NOLA History Guy Podcast. Bye-bye.